Welcome to Wilderness Podcast, a passion project about wilderness and wild places with your host, Adam Bronstein.
Hello, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Wilderness Podcast. If you're listening via web browser, please exit out of that, pick up your smartphone, go to your favorite podcasting app and search for Wilderness Podcast. Look for the green logo with the bear. There you can subscribe to be notified of new releases, go back and check out past episodes, and pick up where you left off on this one. I'd like to remind my listeners that any views expressed on this program by me are mine and mine alone, and do not necessarily reflect those of any other organizations that I am affiliated with. This is the first episode in my mini-series I'm calling Wilderness 30 by 30. And we'll have 5 or 6 episodes. We'll just see what the ultimate tally ends up being. Of course, this is in response to the global initiative that we're hearing so much chatter about now to protect 30% of the Earth's land and ocean by the year 2030. And we'll be speaking with folks all over the country, particularly in the West, who are working on large landscape wilderness bills. A couple of those are already in Congress and have been for quite a long time. So we're hoping that this is the moment to seize upon and to get some big packages through. We'll also be speaking with somebody about national parks and also new ways to approach land protection using indigenous knowledge. So there's a lot to think about with the 30 by 30 initiative and what protection actually means, how we get there, and really where our values lie. The idea for this mini-series came after Biden signed his executive order on climate, I believe that was in late January, where he mentioned 30 by 30, and he asked his advisors to come up with a set of recommendations after 90 days as to how to proceed. There was no mention of wilderness in his executive order. Congress did mention wilderness in their 30 by 30 resolution. I believe it was in the Senate last year, so they're thinking about it. But I want to make sure that the Biden administration is thinking about wilderness designation as a large percentage of the 30 by 30 initiative. Wilderness designation is the gold standard of land protection, and we should be looking at all remaining wilderness quality lands we have left and protecting them under the Wilderness Act of 1964. These lands are dwindling fast. We should have done this a very long time ago, but the politics has always gotten in the way. Now, as we stare down the barrel of the biodiversity and climate crisis, we cannot afford to wait any longer. On U.S. Forest Service land, we have what are called inventoried roadless areas, or IRAs. And the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, has areas called lands with wilderness characteristics. And these are also roadless areas. And on both systems, the Forest Service and BLM, we have what are called wilderness study areas. Inventoried roadless areas, lands with wilderness characteristics, and wilderness study areas. All three should be set aside as wilderness, and that would be a huge step towards 30 by 30. I think this is just an absolute no-brainer that the Biden administration should do. Just a few final thoughts before we jump into the episode. Of course, it would be great to get more land set aside and protected, whether it's wilderness or national parks or some other land designation. But with more lands taken out of the resource base, that just puts more pressure on the lands that still are accessible to industry. Of course, do we want to live in a world where half is set aside for nature and half is set aside for us and is highly polluted and overexploited? This is quite dystopian, if you ask me. So at the same time, we also need to be thinking about degrowing our economies and decreasing our consumption levels. In this episode, I speak with Terry Martin, Intermountain West organizer with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, or SUWA. We talk about the founding of SUWA, how they have been successful in an anti-wilderness and anti-federal lands environment, local control efforts undermining the public trust, new wilderness as part of the 30 by 30 campaign, Native American reception to wilderness in Utah, Bears Ears as a catalyst for 30 by 30, America's Red Rocks Wilderness Act, the spine of the continent, the importance of landscape connectivity, climate mitigation, and climate refugia, SUWA's monthly podcast, and the measurable impacts that activism has on making a difference on the ground. All right, I hope you enjoy this episode and the rest in this series, And thanks for tuning in. Okay, Terry Martin with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. Very happy to have you on the program, and you're helping me kick off my Wilderness 30 by 30 mini-series, I'm calling it. It's a lot to talk about generally with 30 by 30, and really excited to hear about the Red Rocks Wilderness Act that you guys are working on, and I've been a big fan of SUA for a long time. I think you guys are one of the most important voices out there, and you've been around for a while. How long has the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance been working?
Well, hi, Adam. I'm really happy to be here and glad to see you focusing on this issue in your podcast. It's a really important issue, and as you said, it's a very exciting issue at this moment. In terms of Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, we are in our mid-30s, maybe moving into our late 30s, but as an organization, you're proud of that. We were founded back in the 80s, really in the trenches. You know, we were founded at a time when wilderness quality lands were being lost in Utah, and the Bureau of Land Management was doing an inventory to determine which lands were considered to still have wilderness quality and should be protected as wilderness study areas in an interim way until Congress had a chance to decide to make them part of the wilderness system or not. And a handful of people said, we're losing this game. We need citizen activism to turn it around. So SUA was born, and we've moved from the trenches into the halls of Congress, into the courtroom, into high-tech media, we've built, or really just attracted, an incredible network of citizen activists across the country who know and love the Red Rock and want it to be there for the future. So it's a great organization. It's a great place to work, and our cause lives beyond anybody.
How has SUA been so successful in Utah in a generally anti-wilderness environment?
Well, that's a good question, and I would answer it by saying that early on, SUA made a decision that if we focused simply inside the state and tried to negotiate with our own elected officials, that wilderness would be doomed, because there is such a strong, not just anti-wilderness, but anti-federal lands ideology in this state. And that, if we were to focus just in to work with our own delegation, we were on the wrong playing field. We were on a playing field that was tilted utterly against wilderness. And so we made a decision to do several things. One was to build a national constituency and to shift the debate to the halls of Congress, where it was a debate about what citizens across the country thought should happen with their public lands. Of course, Utahns should have a voice, but not the only voice. And second, we decided we needed to focus on holding the line against the loss of wilderness in the meantime, which meant doing everything we could to stop projects that degraded the land. And a lot of that was done through the courts. Anyone who's gone to law school will tell you they run into a lot of SUA v. so-and-so cases. And that work has been hugely effective in not only stopping bad developments, but also in making the Utah delegation realize that the conservation movement in Utah is a force, and it's a force that's not going away. And if we're going to move ahead with getting some certainty about what the future of our public lands look like in Utah, we need to ultimately sit down and negotiate some legislation that addresses the future of those lands, that includes the conservation voice. So those things were key, and the strategy has taken a while to come to fruition, but I would say it has come and continues to come to fruition.
Yeah, you made a really good point, and I'm glad that you've been successful on these merits, and that's the fact that these lands, our federal lands, belong to all Americans, regardless of what state they might fall in and under which delegation might be representing that state. So that's such an important thing to remind everybody, that these lands belong to everybody and we should all have a voice, including those who live within these states, like in Utah. you know, this trying to wrest local control in decision making as a part of collaboration has really not worked out for the public and the public's trust. And this is the drumbeat that you hear over and over. And even with 30 by 30, I'm hearing this drumbeat. I'm reading lots of articles about how we need lots of local decision making. And yes, we do, but we also have to look at the greater context of these lands and how they fit into the greater landscape. And we'll be talking about landscape connectivity here in a little bit. But can you just speak to the collaboration mindset and local control and how we need to be viewing that?
Yeah, there's no question that folks who live locally deserve a seat at the table and that their voice should be considered. But the fact simply that you're lucky enough to be born in and live in a community or to move into a community on the edge of what is the public estate doesn't mean that you own it. It's kind of like thinking about Yellowstone National Park belonging to Wyoming, or the folks in Cody, Wyoming should call the shots predominantly. They should have a seat at the table, but the lands really do belong to everyone. And what we have found in Utah is that our elected officials here like to talk about the importance of local control and how we should defer to it when they agree with the locals. But when they don't agree with the locals ideologically, they completely ignore the idea of local control. You know, for example, here in Utah, we now have a county commission in San Juan County where Bears Ears National Monument is located that is comprised of two Navajo members and a white guy member. And when that election happened a few years ago, that council shifted from anti-Bears Ears to pro-Bears Ears. And recently, the Grand County Commission, which is just north of San Juan, it's where Moab is located, and it is the county that includes part of Canyonlands National Park and Arches National Park, they came out in support of Bears Ears National Monument, as did the town council of Moab. Now, you know, that doesn't go very far with the people up at the state legislature or our elected federal delegation. When President Trump was laying the groundwork to gut Bears Ears and Grand Staircase National Monument, the Chamber of Commerce of Escalante, Utah, which is the main, one of two main, one of three main, well, really one of several small communities next to Grand Staircase, but really one of the major tourist jump-off spots, they were for continuing to protect the monument, as was the town of Boulder. They couldn't get any attention from the Utah delegation. So, you know, this notion of local control often is a smokescreen for an ideological point of view when certain elected officials think that the locals agree with them, but they throw out that idea when the locals disagree with them.
Right. Yeah, I'm really interested to see how this 30 by 30 initiative moves. And everything I'm reading, for the most part, is talking about conservation. And this really is a conservation versus preservation fight. I think that's ramping up. And, you know, maybe there'll be some compromise. This is a really tricky area. And, you know, it seems like everything today has to be financialized in some way or another to justify it. And preservation is quite the opposite. We also have the issues of Native American folks and their involvement with their local lands and how they'd like to see them managed. So there's quite the balancing act to do here. But how do you see wilderness playing into 30 by 30, and is it being talked about enough?
Well, I think the 30 by 30 campaign is a really brilliant campaign, because what it does is create a big umbrella under which lots of different kinds of land protection proposals, which are supported by a lot of different communities coming at it from different angles, that they can argue for their proposal, and their proposal is an important piece. So getting to 30 by 30, and maybe we should back up and make sure that your listeners understand that 30 by 30 is really a global campaign that emerged out of the scientifically based notion that if we are going to stop the loss of species and the risk of extinction, if we're going to address climate change, if we're going to save nature for humans as well as all other forms of life, that we need to protect really 50% of the planet's lands and oceans. 30 by 30 is based on the idea of let's start by protecting 30% of the world's lands and oceans by 2030 and then move on to try and do more beyond that. And it's a campaign that's got incredible support and attention around the world. And here in the United States, there was a poll maybe a year and a half ago by Center for American Progress, which showed 86% of the respondents, which were citizens from around the country, supported it. There was a recent Colorado College poll that showed throughout the West, support, I think it was somewhere around 75%. So this is a concept that really appeals to people. And I think of it as putting together a puzzle that has many puzzle pieces. And those puzzle pieces can reflect different approaches to land protection and varying strengths of land protection. Now, we're wilderness advocates, and wilderness is a very high form of protection, and we need a substantial amount of that kind of protection in order for the ecological integrity of our landscapes to stand up. But I think 30 by 30 is a big umbrella, and while it's messy, I don't think we need to worry too much, because what it does well is to embrace the idea that we need many different kinds of puzzle pieces. We would argue that one of the most important puzzle pieces or types of puzzle piece are large landscapes that not only protect a substantial amount of land, but also help to increase landscape connectivity. And landscape connectivity is basically creating connections between other large ecosystems. And we can talk more about what that means and how America's Red Rock Wilderness Act fits into that.
Yeah, let's definitely jump into that. I guess one other question I have or concern, or maybe we just kind of unpack this a little bit more, but you know, what Americans are expecting under 30 by 30 might be one thing, and they're actually going to be getting another. You know, conservation to a lot of folks means protection, but to others, what it actually means is use, right? So the way we use our lands, the way we graze them and mine them and log them, and all of these extractions are actually fall underneath the conservation umbrella. So while we're hoping to protect some areas as wilderness, the rest of the landscape is going to be more vulnerable to an increased demand on resource use. So how do we consider those impacts? You know, it's kind of like we can't have a free lunch.
I think if you look at the definition of 30 by 30 and the definition of what 30 by 30 considers protected, and all this is still taking shape in some ways, you would see that protected lands are considered those that are predominantly natural and or can be restored to being natural, and that surface disturbances like extractive industries are not allowed. And I think the general direction is that new roads is not allowed. Grazing is probably something that I think lands would qualify as being seen as protected, even though they're grazed. And that, as you know, someone who knows more about that than I do, that can be a problem because there's huge ecological impacts. But I think really the intent of 30 by 30 is not to be a veneer under which actual development happens. I think it's meant really to protect, conserve, preserve, whichever word you want to use, areas that remain natural or can be restored.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. But in the meantime, I'd like to see more wilderness designated. And I also want to speak with you about how working with Native American tribes has been under the with wilderness designations. Can you just speak on that first before we dive into Red Rocks?
Frame your question for me again.
Sure.
Regarding the tribes.
Yeah, how has wilderness designation been received by the tribes? Have they supported it, not supported it, or somewhere in the middle?
I would say that it, from my perspective here in Utah, this is an evolving picture, and it's really fertile ground at the moment. One of the most exciting things that's happened, I would say, in the last few years is this alliance might not be quite the right word, but this relationship that's been developing between the Native American communities, the tribes, and the conservation communities here. The tribes are a really important voice. They're a voice that deserves to be heard, to be at the table at all times. And the tribes here have a very strong and alive connection to the landscape. It's a connection that I think the wilderness movement has overlooked for a long time, and we are guilty of that. The Wilderness Act was passed at a time by people who didn't think about the effect of that act, its language, on the Native American community. And, you know, we definitely have responsibility around that. But fundamentally, there is huge common ground between what wilderness activists are trying to do, which is to protect areas that are predominantly natural from exploitation and degradation, and the tribes who value these lands as ancestral homelands, as sacred sites, as places of sustenance where they gather, where they hunt, or gather herbs and other materials, and as most fundamentally as a relative. And so I think we're very much in the process here in Utah of building those relationships, of spending time listening to each other, and particularly conservation groups, I think, listening to tribes, and asking the question, how can we work together in a way that serves both of us? And, you know, this exciting period was really born out of the Bears Ears National Monument campaign. That was the Bears Ears Monument was really a tribal idea. It was proposed by, and really carried by the tribes. The whole idea of the monument was to protect this place that was very important to these five tribes and others, and also to change the narrative where we understood these lands as important to the tribes and to start to tell that narrative. So it was such an exciting monument because our monuments really tell the story of who we are as a people in the U.S. They help generations to come who visit them to learn about who we are. And this was a way to tell the story from the tribe's perspective. And as the tribes so powerfully said, their main theme was around healing. And they said that this monument proclamation needs to happen for healing, not just for the tribes, but for everybody. And it was a very powerful vision, and we saw our role as standing with them, behind them, and supporting them. And that, you know, began some relationships, some of which we already had, some of which deepened, and some of which were new, that we're continuing to build on.
Were there wilderness overlays in the monument? I don't remember.
Tribes proposed protecting 1.9 million acres. Obama's proclamation was for 1.45, about 1.5 million. And I would say, I should know this, but 85% of that are lands that are proposed for wilderness protection inside America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. A similar substantial percentage, although smaller, are some of it is already wilderness study areas. So there's a huge overlap. And, you know, SUA could have said, we don't want a monument. We want wilderness. But that's not what we said. We said, this is a super visionary, super powerful idea. This is a great way to protect these lands and a great, great way to tell their story. And, you know, we fully support it, and we worked on it really hard.
Is there an overlay of wilderness, kind of like in Yosemite National Park, where some of their backcountry areas are designated wilderness and in the system? Is that present in Bears Ears? I don't recall.
Well, Bears Ears doesn't have... Trump reduced Obama's Bears Ears by 85% a year after...
In the Obama proposal. Is there overlay in the Obama?
So it needed to have... That kind of decision would be made in the management plan, a general management plan that would be written. Like, how do you manage it? Do you manage some areas under... As quote, wilderness, and what does that mean? How do you deal with different kinds of uses, meaning mostly in terms of visitation? And so all that was poised to happen. How do you tell the story of this place? And Trump shot it down, and now the Biden administration has indicated they intend to restore it. So what's exciting is we should be entering into a management planning process for Bears Ears, which... hopefully we'll do what the Obama proclamation intended, which is to treat the tribes as co-managers. And so they should have a huge hand in that management plan. It would be something that comes out in draft that citizens can read and comment on. And so those kinds of things are still to be determined.
Okay. All right. Well, let's move on to the Red Rocks Wilderness Act. And let's just start by, what is the spine of the continent?
So the spine of the continent is an area and an idea. The spine of the continent is a chain of landscapes or ecosystems that stretch from the border with Mexico up through the Intermountain West, reaching into Colorado, reaching into Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, on into Wyoming, Montana, and into the Canadian and Alaskan Arctic. So it's a chain of ecosystems that form the spine of the continent. It's also been called the Western Wild Way. And for some time, conservationists, biologists, wildlife advocates have said, we should look at this area as a whole region because the wildlife that live in it, the ecosystems in it, depend on each other, and the wildlife that live in this spine move from one ecosystem to the other. And what we need to do is protect these landscapes in a way where they're connected, and animals and even plants can move and migrate. And that is even more true under climate change, as plant and wildlife habitat comes under stress, that makes it all the more harder to survive, much less thrive. And America's Red Rock Wilderness Act is one of the big landscapes or ecosystems that is a piece of that chain of landscapes. It sits about midway in that spine, and it's a critical link in that chain.
And when I look at the map, you guys have beautiful maps and brochures. I will post those on your episode page. But the Red Rocks Wilderness Act is massive. It really fills out quite a bit of the landscape.
Yes, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act would protect 9 million acres of federal land or public land that's managed by the Bureau of Land Management. We don't look at the forests. They're very important, too, but SUA, as an organization, focuses on BLM land. And as I said, it sits centrally in this chain of landscapes. And America's Red Rock Wilderness Act predominantly contains what people know as the Red Rock Canyon Country of southern Utah. It's the land that surrounds or is tangential to our national park system units predominantly. And it also includes landscapes that are still wild in what we call Utah's West Desert, which is Basin and Range Province. And in terms of 30 by 30, the reason why America's Red Rock Wilderness Act is a particularly helpful piece of the 30 by 30 puzzle is first and foremost that protecting lands in that act would protect one of the largest unprotected expanses of wild country in the lower 48. And specifically, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act alone accounts for 1.5% of the remaining land that needs to be conserved to reach the goal of protecting 30%. And that's a big piece of the 30 by 30 puzzle for just one proposal. But equally important is the fact that passage of America's Red Rock Wilderness Act would increase landscape connectivity in the region. And that connectivity is critical to mitigating the extinction and the climate crises. The way I suggest people who are listening, like to a podcast, to think about this is to imagine in their mind a map of the Intermountain West. And you'll see that our existing network of protected lands, our national parks, our wilderness areas, our wildlife refuges, they appear on that map as fragments of land that are largely isolated from each other. So you think there's Yellowstone, and then over here there's Rocky Mountain National Park, and then down there there's Grand Canyon National Park, and up there there's Glacier. But the sad reality is that these isolated fragments are simply not large enough to sustain a healthy diversity of species and habitats. And as a result, the distribution in numbers of many wildlife and plant populations in the U.S. has declined, and that's resulted in this loss of biodiversity and this increasing risk of extinctions. And as I said, climate change just makes this worse. So what we need to do, as the 30 by 30 campaign recognizes, is to protect more land, but as important, we need to protect large landscapes that connect these ecosystems and wildlife habitat. And that's what America's Red Rock Wilderness Act does. Our research shows that passing America's Red Rock Wilderness Act would specifically conserve or protect five key wildlife corridors. These wildlife corridors facilitate wildlife movement along the spine of the continent and connect places like the Colorado Plateau. They run from like Grand Canyon up through America's Red Rock Wilderness Act to Yellowstone, or they run from lands on the Colorado Plateau over to Rocky Mountain National Park, the Rocky Mountains in the southwest corner of Colorado, the San Juan Mountains, and so on. Or they run up through from the Greater Canyonlands or Bears Ears area up to Grand Teton. And deer, elk, pronghorn antelope, bighorn sheep, black bear, mountain lion, and potentially wolves all use these corridors. So the point is that protecting lands in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act not only moves us towards the goal of 30 by 30 by protecting a big chunk of deserving country, but it also increases this landscape connectivity, which enhances ecosystem health and wildlife health in the entire region. And that's, you know, we are proponents of protecting America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, but this argument about landscape connectivity can really apply to many other landscape proposals in the spine of the continent region.
Okay, and how far along is this bill? Do you have sponsors?
Oh, America's Red Rock Wilderness Act. We reintroduce it every time there's a new Congress. It's been, it was first introduced, let's see, in 1985. It wasn't as flushed out then. We've had as many as, can I get this right, 25 co-sponsors in the Senate, and I think once up to 140 in the House. You know, we see reintroducing this bill and gathering co-sponsors not only as a way to, when the time is right, try and pass the whole bill, but in the meantime, to create a foundation to possibly pass smaller pieces of wilderness legislation that protect part of the bill, or to work with an administration to do things that can administratively protect those lands in the meantime. So it's a huge organizing tool and protection tool beyond just passing the entire act. But, you know, Adam, one other thing we should touch on related to 30 by 30 and America's Red Rock Wilderness Act and wilderness is this connection between protecting natural landscapes or wilderness, protecting wilderness, and mitigating climate change by reducing the amount of carbon we're putting into the atmosphere and the amount of carbon we're able to take out of the atmosphere. So if you'll give me a minute, I can explain what some pretty exciting new research we did shows about that.
Please do.
So one of the exciting things about 30 by 30 is it makes this connection between addressing the climate crises and protecting land. And a piece of that, as I said, is reducing the emission of carbon while simultaneously removing carbon from the atmosphere, because carbon is the big culprit in climate change. And we hired a consulting firm called EcoAdapt, and they did an analysis to look at what would be the contribution to mitigating climate change if those lands were protected. One thing they found is that the passage of the Red Rocks Act would make a significant contribution because it would leave undeveloped a substantial amount of fossil fuels, oil, gas, tar sands, oil, shale, coal. And the way they measure this is against what's known as the carbon budget. The carbon budget is based on the Paris Agreement, which identifies the amount of carbon that can be released into the atmosphere before global temperatures reach more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's considered the tipping point, as many of your listeners probably know, into severe and irreversible impacts. So what EcoAdapt's research showed is that protecting lands in the Red Rocks Act would permanently keep in the ground greenhouse gases or carbon equivalent to 5.7% of the carbon budget necessary to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. And again, that's a significant piece for a single proposal. And just like 30 by 30, addressing climate's got to be made up of multiple pieces everywhere. And then there's this piece of taking carbon out of the atmosphere, which is known as sequestration and storage, which is done by plants and animals, I mean plants and soils. And there's been a lot of attention to the role that tropical rainforests play in sequestering and storing carbon. But the research by EcoDAP shows that dry land ecosystems, like desert ecosystems, can make a significant difference also. That pinyon juniper forests, shrublands, and even desert biocrust all play a role. In terms of measurable terms, EcoDAP's research showed that if the plants and soils in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act are left undisturbed, that the amount of carbon stored in those plants and soils would increase nearly 10% by the end of the century. And that's substantial for a desert ecosystem. So, and then one other thing is that, and this overlaps with protecting landscapes and wildlife connectivity, is that lands in America's Red Rock Wilderness Act contain a substantial amount of what's known as climate refugia. These are areas on the landscape that are buffered from climate extremes, and they are places where wildlife and plants even can take refuge for a while over time while they adapt to climate change, or they are able to change their range. And they are kind of like a temporary safe haven. America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, because of its topographic diversity, has a lot of climate refugia. So to us, that's really exciting to bring together these arguments that protecting land can help address our climate crises, which, of course, is a huge thing that we need to act on and which the Biden administration understands we need to act on.
And we did talk a little bit about cattle grazing. You know, cattle destroy the soil crusts and all that. So, you know, this is definitely another component, but not something that you guys are working on. You guys are just doing the land protection side, which I very much appreciate. But I just want to remind my listeners that cows do really impact the ability for these arid lands to sequester and store carbon long term. So
yeah,
well, this
absolutely.
This is all exciting stuff, Terry, and look forward to hopefully see this move and get some momentum. And
well,
I'll be following very closely.
Yeah, well, we are very keen on encouraging other land protection groups in the spine of the continent or the Intermountain region in using this argument around landscape connectivity to advance their proposal. Because I think if multiple groups with multiple landscape proposals in that region stand together and say to the Biden administration, you know, the benefits of land protection are greatly enhanced if a landscape helps connect ecosystems. You're really helping enhance the health of the region. And 30 by 30 is a puzzle, but let's make sure we have those puzzle pieces connecting to each other. And so it's, for me, a really exciting concept that we're using to pitch Protecting America's Red Rock Ruralness Act, but we really want to stand with other organizations to make this pitch in this region, because the health of the whole, the health of each individual landscape really depends on the health of the whole. And 30 by 30 is a concept that makes that clear and that we could work under. So it's an exciting moment. Biden has asked the Department of Interior to identify actions they can take to advance the 30 by 30 goal. So it's a good time for organizations to be weighing in about, you know, not just their proposal, but these ideas that can help advance a lot of proposals.
Yeah, for sure. And that's part of the impetus for this little mini-series, too, is to go around the U.S. and talk to folks such as yourself who have these large landscape protection visions, and, you know, hopefully give it all a little bit of a boost, because this really does feel like an opportunity. But yeah, this is all great stuff. And so Sua has a podcast. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, thanks. I was just remembering that I should bring that up. So Sua does a monthly podcast called Wild Utah. If you want to track it down, simply use those words, Wild Utah. And if you care about wilderness, if you care about Utah's Red Rock Canyon country, you'll want to subscribe and listen into this podcast. We look at issues relevant to the future of those lands. We explore hot issues like our new report about how America's Red Rock Wilderness Act can move us towards 30 by 30 and mitigate climate. And we also talk about issues that need activists' attention. And there's always something new on the burner on that front. So we keep it pretty short. Most podcasts are, I don't know, 20 minutes or so. And so it's a pretty quick listen. I think we do a nice job of it. So plug in Wild Utah and take a look, take a listen.
Yeah, you guys do a very nice job with that. I had a listen to the episode that you shared with me that you did on Red Rocks Wilderness, and it was very well done. So how can people find out more about Sua? Where can they go online?
Well, it's pretty simple, www.sua, that's SUWA.org, or, you know, you can also Google Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, I think. That's our website, and you can find us on social media as well, and I should have all those little connections right in front of me, but I don't, because I'm in my office where I never am, but easy enough to find us on Twitter and Instagram. We keep a pretty, as well as Facebook, we keep a pretty good flow of interesting posts that would be interesting to anybody who cares about wilderness or the Red Rock.
Okay, any closing thoughts on 30 by 30?
Well, I think I really appreciate, Adam, you doing a show about that and reaching out to people throughout the region, because I think that's the way to think about it. And we're glad to be on your first effort to do that.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time and all the great work that you guys do. Keep it up. And
thanks,
everyone,
Adam.
Check out the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance and all the great work that they're doing down in Utah. And thanks
and
for your time.
I guess I got to close by saying what really makes a difference on these issues, and I've worked in this field for, 30 or 40 years, is citizen activism. And I think that sometimes activists feel kind of alone and wonder, what difference does it make when they submit a comment or write a letter to the editor or even just get the word out by making a post on social media? But I've been working as an organizer, and as an organizer, you sort of get to sit at the middle of the wheel that spins around you, and you see what a huge difference each individual spoke or action makes. It's what creates the strength of the wheel. It's what makes the wheel turn, and you see all that add up. So I just need to make a thank you for anyone out there who's ever taken action in any form, and you know, to remind them to trust that they're not alone. They're part of a much bigger community that I've seen make a difference and will continue to make a difference.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and this podcast has been really great for that too. So I'm really always awesome hearing stories that, you know, if different people get connected up. And so if people want to be outspoken and support the Red Rocks, America's Red Rocks Wilderness Act, what actions can they take?
So the most important thing, I would say that the way to get plugged in is to go to SUA's Facebook page and to SUA's webpage and sign up to be on our email list. We only send out one email a week at best, but it does keep you updated as to what you can do now that makes a difference. You know, we'd love for people to join, but if you don't have the money to join at the time, you can just sign up. And another key piece is being part of our effort to convince members of Congress around the country to be co-sponsors of America's Red Rock Wilderness Act, because as I explained, the future of the Red Rock really depends on support from senators and Congress people from around the country, not from inside Utah, unfortunately. And we work all the time. We have organizers across the country working with activists in different regions to meet with their members of Congress. So if you're interested in that, you can actually send an email to me at Terry, T-E-R-R-I, at SUA.org, or simply get on our website and send a general information email, and we'll send you to the right organizer, because we're just about to launch our new Congress campaign to recruit new co-sponsors, to renewed and new co-sponsors for America's Red Rock Wilderness Act.
Okay. Thanks for your time this evening, Terry, and I hope to speak with you again sometime soon.
Same, Adam. Great job you're doing. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Wilderness Podcast. You can find us online at wildernesspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe through your podcasting app. If you'd like to support this podcast, please visit wildernesspodcast.com/support. Thanks for listening.